Okay, good morning. Let's see. Okay, the plan for today is to continue looking at this class of Riemann integrable functions, and they're two types of things I want to do with these Riemann integrable functions. Right now I have the lemmas from last time up, and we'll come back and use those. But today, as I said, more with Riemann integrable functions. And the name for that was R int on AB. So those were the integrable functions on R on AB. And the two things that I want to do with it are to add a norm and study, or almost a norm, and study the properties of that. And then to try to expand the list of functions and try to understand all of the Riemann integrable functions. So let's see, maybe I'll just start with the norm, and then we'll move to looking at what we know about, let me just list what we know. So we know already. Okay, so we know that the Riemann integrable functions form a vector space. Right, and that we got from 11.32 and 11.33. Let's see, I guess 11.32 I still have over on the right here. So that says that we can take a constant and multiply it, and we get another Riemann integrable function. Okay, so that's one thing you need for a vector space. And the other thing you have to do is be able to add, that one is here, so I'm afraid I have to scroll off what I just wrote, which is poor form, but in any case, I'll scroll it back. But you can add these two functions and use Andrew's cylinder. So those are the two things that you need for vector space, so we have those. The other things that we knew were we have a bunch of examples. So we also know that continuous functions are Riemann integrable. Right, and let's see, what was that? That was 11.28. And we also found increasing functions, whether or not they're continuous, they could have jumps, were contained in here, and similarly decreasing, and this is 11.30. That's still not everything. And we're gonna try to get a handle on everything at some point. And what, for example, is missing, let me just start with one. If I take the function f of x equals one if x is a half and otherwise zero. So there's an example, which is Riemann integrable, right? So we computed its integral, but on 0, 1, say, but it's not of the above type, but not, above. Okay, so we're not done, all right? There's more to go, and so we're trying to figure out what those are. Actually, just keeping it this in mind, of course, if I graph this function, it looks like this. What is that integral? People remember that?
Wasn't it just zero?
Yeah, it's just zero, right? So the lower ones are always gonna be zero, but the upper ones, you have a little piece, but you can make it as small as you like, right? So you get zero from that, okay? So yes, you are correct. It was zero, okay? Very good. All right, so those are the functions that we have. As I said, the first thing that I want to do today is to try to introduce a norm-like thing to it, and this is the L1. So definition. If I have a Riemann integrable function, then I'm going to define the L1 of it. So L1, and it's just going to be the integral of the absolute, but I want to know how big it is. So it's going to be the integral of the absolute value f of x dx from a to b. So that's my definition of L1. Okay. And now I'm trying to compare this to a normed linear space. So let me just recall what a normal linear space is, and then we'll see how close we are. So recall, and this is, I guess, definition 13.20. A normal linear space. So if we have a vector space, and that we do, right? So that we have, and if X is a vector space, real vector space. Okay, and this Rint is a good example. That's a vector space. Then a double bar thing is a norm, is a normal linear space, is a normal linear space. If, okay, and so there are three things that we need, and we're gonna see which of those are true. So there's property zero, which says that if the norm is zero, then F is zero. Okay. And then there's the scaling property. It says that if we have any constant C, you know, in the real, then the norm of any C times F is just the C, well, absolute C times the norm of F, okay? And then finally, there's the triangle property, which says, well, here we start with two functions. So if we have F and G, then we can relate the norm of the sum. Well, it's not equal, but it's at least bounded by the sum of the norms. Right, so those are the three properties. And so I would like to now compare what we have to a nonlinear space. So the first thing to notice is that if I take this R int on AB and use this norm that I gave, this L1 double bar, this is not a nonlinear space. Okay, so can anyone see why it's not? What goes wrong here? So let me give a little bit of a hint at least. So first of all, we have to have a vector space, and that we do, right? So this is a vector space. So we have that. So this is true. Okay, but what about this zero property? So that would say that that if the norm is zero, then the function is zero.
You've already like have that example of f, which shows that it fails because f isn't the zero function.
Exactly, that's exactly right. So does everyone follow that? So this is precisely an example that shows that zero property fails because it's just as you say, this is not the zero function. It's mostly zero, but it's not the zero function because it's one at a half. And nonetheless, it's a norm, which since it's positive, it's just its integral, is zero, okay? So that's why it goes wrong. But that's actually the only problem, and that's what we're gonna see next. Since the norm of F above, and we just copy, I guess, same as I wrote above, then as above, the norm of F, L1 is just integral of the absolute value of F from 0 to 1, which since F is positive, that's just the integral of the function itself, equals zero, but the function is not zero. Okay, so so this one fails. So that's where we are. All right, and now what I would like to do is put the other two work. Okay, so let me do that. Actually, I'll do one and I'll let you guys do the other, but let me start with the first one. All right, so claim. So what does this scaling property say? If we have a real number and a remeasurable function, then I claim that the norm of C times F, this L1 norm, I'm going to keep calling it a norm, even though it's not quite, is equal to the size of C times the norm of F, okay? All right, so proof. So what do we need to do? We just have to compute the L1 norm of C times F. So let's just try that computation. So let me just note what I'm going to use. So I'm going to use the fact, let's see, where did I put it up here? I guess it's on this side. I'm going to use this fact here. Sorry, once again, I scrolled off what I was writing. I apologize. I'm going to use this fact that when I multiply by C, I know what happens to the integral, okay? So this 11.32 says that the integral of C times F is equal to C times the integral of F, okay? So that's what we're gonna use. So let me do it. So so let me just compute. So the norm of C times F, this L1 norm by definition is integral from a to b of the absolute value of f of x dx. I dropped my c, didn't I? Apologize. I put the c back in. Absolute value of c times f of x. That's the thing we're computing, right? Okay, and but this is the same, of course, as the absolute value of c times absolute value of f. Product of absolute value of the product is the product of absolute values. And then this is equal to absolute value of C times the integral of absolute value of F. And so then we're done. So that's the norm of C times the, the absolute value of C times the L1 norm of F. Okay, just as advertised. Any questions about that? So I hope that's clear. All right, and just to check that it's clear, let me let you guys in breakout rooms. I'll give you about 4 minutes to prove the following claim, which is the second one. Oh yeah, maybe I'll just mention over here. So so we proved this one's true, right? And now we're gonna prove the next one, the triangle inequality. So claim, and this is the triangle. If we have two functions, f and g, which are both Riemann integrable on the same interval AB, then I want you to show that the L1 norm of their sum is bounded by the sum of the L1 norms. Okay, and let me just note, just like above, what is going to come into play here. So I want to make use of the theorems that we proved last time. I think so we're on this side this time. Right, so 11.33 here, it says that it works nice that integrals are linear, right? So if I take a sum, then I get a sum out of it, right? So integrals are linear. So 11.33, integral of f plus g is equal to the integral of f plus the integral of g, right? That's the 11.33. And then the other fact that we proved is this 11.39. It says that if we have a f which is less than g, then actually we got for both u and l, but in particular for the integral, we have that the integral is also monotone. So this is monotonicity. 11.39. If we have that f is less than g, then So if it's monotone, then this integral is R less. So it's a monotone linear function. Okay, let's see. So any questions about that? What I want you to do, I want you to just try to do that in about 3 minutes. And maybe I'll put in breakout rooms so teach you how to chat. Okay, let's see. So did people get that to work? Yes.
So we know that the absolute value of fx plus gx is, sorry, I mean, yeah.
Oh, you mean the actual absolute value, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that's always less than or equal to the absolute value of f of x plus the absolute value of g of x.
Correct.
And then, so from 11.39, we know that like the integral of the left is less than or equal to the
correct.
Yeah, so that's less than the integral of the individual pieces. Mm-hmm. And then from linearity, like from 11.33, we know that we can split the integral. And so basically now we have that like the left hand side originally is basically just the L1 norm of f plus g, and we have that the right hand side is the L1 norm of f plus the L1 norm of g.
Okay, does everyone get that? Is that how people did that? So that made use of both of those 11.33 and 11.39. And it gives precisely what we wanted. So we get this triangle inequality holding for arbitrary demonstrable functions. Okay, so that's where we are. So it's almost a normal-linear space, except for the zeros. And there are a couple of different ways to deal with that. There's one approach which gives you a class called L1 after a couple different steps, which we're not going to do, and that's but you'll see that in a more advanced class on a functional analysis. However, there's another thing you can do, and we will do that because both are useful. It's nice to have both, and one of them is something that we can do. So let me do that, and that's to restrict to a smaller space where it is a norm linear space. Okay, so let me do that. So this follows from the following claim, which is 11.42 in the text. And it says that if we, instead of taking an arbitrary Riemann integrable function, take the much smaller space, where we go up here, that we know that includes a continuous function, so I'm going to take a continuous function. Okay, so if we have a continuous function, and its L1 norm is zero, then it in fact must be the zero function. Okay, so it works at least if we are in that special case. Okay, so let's just try this proof. And let me start with a little picture over here and then copy it into notation. So I'm going to, for contradiction, assume that we have such a function that contradicts our assertion. So for contradiction, assume that we have f continuous, f of some value there, c is not zero, so it's not the zero function, and the norm is zero. So then we want to get a contradiction. Okay, so in my picture over here, I have some value c out here inside of my interval from a to b. And my function has a value which is non-zero there, all right? And the picture is going to be that since it's, so this is what happened over here, right? We had a function that was non-zero at one point. Where'd my drawing go here? But it then immediately became zero, but it's not continuous. And if it's continuous, then it has to be non-zero in a neighborhood. And that's what we're going to use, okay? So it means that it has to look kind of like this and be non-zero in a little neighborhood. Okay. And what that's going to tell us is that if I take a small enough interval here, so let's take this point to be, say, C minus delta, then I'm going to get a box here with positive area. Okay. And that's going to give me a lower bound for the integral. Okay. So I'm just going to use a very simple partition, which has got this A in it, it's got this C minus delta, it's got C, and it's got B, and that's it. So just that little tiny partition. And then I'm going to use that to get a lower bound on my integral, and that'll contradict it being zero. Okay, so that's the approach. Let me write that out now in formula. So, so where did that delta come from? It comes from the fact that my function is continuous. Okay, so since f is continuous, and it's continuous in particular at C, we can choose a delta. So there exists a delta greater than zero, so that whenever I take an x here that's within this interval, so between C and within delta of C, then we have that. Let me add one more thing before I get here. Since this is non-zero, I want to give it a name. Okay, I should always name everything, and I forgot to do that. So let me name this. I'm going to name that 2 epsilon. I can do that because I can. It's non-zero. Okay, and I'll assume it's positive, and I'm going to give it a name 2 epsilon. Okay. All right, now I can choose my delta associated with that epsilon, and that's what I'm going to do. So I have the size of f of x minus f of c is bigger than epsilon. Okay, hence. Okay, so what does that enable me to say about the size of f of And actually, let me just stick absolute values just to be precise here, because that's the function I'm going to be integrating to absolute values, so might as well. Okay, so what can I say about the size of f of x? Can anyone see that? So I have this value is 2 epsilon here, and x is close enough to C that the difference between f of x and f of C is at most epsilon. And what did I write wrong? Most epsilon. Okay. So then what can I say about the size of f of x. Is that clear?
Would it be less than epsilon plus the absolute value of f of c?
That's right. And since the absolute value of f of c was 2 epsilon, right? Then I moved it by at most epsilon, that difference is going to be at least epsilon. I'll write it and see if it makes sense. So this is always going to be bigger than epsilon, okay? Because I started out here at f of c, which was 2 epsilon, and I moved by something less than epsilon, okay? So I still get something that's bigger than 2 epsilon. Write it down. Any question about that? That's the crux of the argument, okay, is that we are forced to be bigger than epsilon, bigger than some number. Okay, so now we can do the computation. Therefore, okay, so let's see, so we have zero is equal to this integral, so that's equal to the lower integral of the absolute value of f. Okay, and that's bigger than or equal to what I get by, whoops. Bigger than or equal to, I said, and wrote the opposite. Okay, bigger than or equal to L that we get by looking at a particular partition. Okay, and as I advertised, the partition I'm going to look at is just the one I've written here. It's got A and it's got this C minus delta and C and B. Let me call it P. P is equal to just A and C minus delta and C and B, or actually maybe I'll take the other side, A and C and C plus delta and B. So in that case, a little neighborhood of a little interval next to C on one side or the other. And so then this is bigger than or equal to, okay, well, let's see the first term. What can I say about this first term? Well, this is positive because it's an absolute value. So this is at least zero, okay? So this is positive. Okay, and then the one that's actually interesting is this middle term, right? This this green term, and that's gonna be this delta is its width, and epsilon at least is its height. It could be bigger than that, but it's at least epsilon. Okay, and plus a positive. So that's just this epsilon delta, which is greater than zero, which is a contradiction because I now have zero is bigger than zero. Okay, any questions about that? So there's my proof. All right, so can anyone see why I have two different possible partitions there? For P here. So I took either the one on the left side here or the one on the right side there. So what happens if C is all the way over here at A? See that, so I said here that I was going to take P to be one or the other. Which one am I going to choose if C is equal to A? Yeah, okay, so I see it in the chat box, I've taken the second one. Because if I take the first one, it's off the edge, right? So it's not inside of my interval. Right. So any partition has to start at A and end at B, but if C is actually equal to A, then this thing is off the edge, so it doesn't work. But one of the two will work, right? And so either the left little interval or the right little interval is inside this bigger interval. So one or the other is going to work. So I need to note that I have to choose one or the other. Okay. Okay. Any questions about that? So. Where does that leave us? So that says that, that this works for C0, for the continuous functions. All right, so combining these corollary if I take the continuous functions on AB and use this L1, now I can fairly call it a norm, L1 norm, then this is a norm linear space. Okay, and let me just say one more thing about it before moving on to the second thing I want to do today, which is to expand the class of, to try to understand more functions that are Riemann integrable. I want to really like to understand all of them, in fact, but we're just going to expand it a bit more now. The last thing I want to do is to compare this to the other norm. So what's another normed norm that I have on this same space of continuous functions? And remember, so we already looked at a norm on this space, but it was a different one. So same space, different norm. So which norm makes sense here?
The soup norm?
Yeah, exactly. Right, so if people remember that, so the soup norm makes sense here. So, and that was in fact Banach. So, in particular, it is another norm linear space. Okay. The first one actually is not Banach. You might think about an example of that. We'll come back to that later. But for now, let me just note the relationship between these. Note. And what I want to claim is that there's a relationship between these two, that one is bigger than the other almost. So if we have f, a continuous function on AB, then the L1 norm of f, its integral of its absolute value, is less than or equal to the length of the interval b minus a times the other one, times the soup norm. Okay, and I claim that there's a picture that makes that, I hope, fairly intuitive, which is that if I have a function here and I compare the soup norm times the width, that's that red area, to the L1 norm, that's that black area. The red area is big, okay? And so that's what the claim is. So let me just write that out now as a formula, but that's the picture. So poof. All right, and one way to say that is to take the very simplest possible partition, so just the AB itself, just those two points, and use that as the partition. So proof, the one norm, L1 norm, sorry, of f was equal to the integral of the absolute value a to b, f of x dx, absolute value f of x dx. And so this is also goes by the name of u of the absolute value of f. Okay, and it's less than or equal to the U for any partition. And so we can take the very simplest, as I advertised, that partition, just AB, okay, to the very coarsest of all partitions, and just compute what that is. And by definition, that's just, well, there's only one interval. So it's the width of that interval times that height. And so the width is going to be the B minus A, which we see up in our formula, times, and the height is just the soup. X in the interval AB of f of x, absolute value f of x, and that's the soup norm. So this is B minus A times the soup norm of f by definition. Okay, so we're done. Any questions about that? So the two are related, and we will come back and see that this is actually quite handy. This is a useful fact because we learned a lot about things that converge in soup norm already, And we can make use of all those things we already learned to tell us about things that now converge in L1 and use it to get integrals out of. So that'll be the utility of that later. Okay, but if there are no questions about that, I want to shift gears now and go to trying to expand. So what we did, we took the Riemann integral, we focused on just the continuous ones for now. Now I want to go back and try to understand all those other Riemann integrable functions that are out there and see if we can get a handle on those, okay? That's the next step. Okay. Right, so identifying other Riemann integrable functions. We've already identified a few, right? As I listed before, we have the continuous functions, we have increasing, we have decreasing, and we have this one where we have it's just different at one point, but those don't really fit together very well. So it's clear that we don't really have a good answer yet for what they all look like, okay? And so we're gonna expand on that. And so the first one will be this 11.44. That says that if I have one Riemann integral function, another Riemann integral function, I can just stick them together and get another one, okay? And so let me just draw the picture first. I think it's fairly intuitive. I have an A and let me just stick a C out in the middle there somewhere. And if I take an integrable function here and an integrable function there, and they meet somewhere here, then the result is integrable because the area under this one and the area under that one just add up. And I get the area under the total. So that's the claim. And let me turn that into an exact statement first and then prove it. So the following are equivalent. So F, a bounded function. Well, actually, let me put in all my quantifiers. I'll count quantifiers. So I'm going to have that C. So if A, that's equal to C, that's equal to B, okay? Then F, a bounded function on this whole space, AB, is Riemann integrable, if and only if I restrict it to the first interval, so F restricted to AC, and if I restrict it to the second interval, both of them are Riemann integrable. Okay, so that is the claim. I hope the statement is clear. Any questions about the statement of the claim? Okay, so then let me at least sketch a proof of that. There are several steps to it, many of which are similar. So I'll just do one of them and note that the rest are similar, which I hope will be clear. So proof sketch. So first, let's just run through the logic. So let's see the logic here. This is an if and only if statement, right? So I have to go both directions, right? So I have to say that if I have something that's integrable here, then its restrictions are both integrable. And I have to say that if I have restrictions that are integrable, then the original thing is integrable. Have to do both. Let me do this one and then I claim the other one similar and you can try that one. It's very similar. But sketch. So let's start with this direction. Okay, since we will need to do both. And that means that I'm going to assume that I have this one integrable, that one integrable, and I want, oh, sorry. And let me add one more fact. Both. And maybe I'll add a different color because I added it late. And I can write down the integral, which is going to come out of the proof. And so it's a handy thing to just write down since we'll have it. The integral of the sum of the total thing is the sum of the integrals. Integral from A to B of fx dx is just the integral from A to C plus the integral from C to A, C to B. So that's not only integrable, but we can write down what the integral is. Okay, so we're going to do that. Now, to show that something is integrable, what do I have to do? I have to show that the upper and lower things are the same. So, so the sketch, so I will assume f restricted to AC and f restricted to CB are integrable. Okay, and I want to show that f is, but let me just write out what that means. To show that f is, I want to show that the left and the upper and lower approximations are the same. So L of f is equal to u of f is equal to exactly the u and the integral of the restrictions. So the integral of f restricted to AC plus the integral of f restricted to CB. Right, so that's what I need to show. Okay, and so that's two things. So let me start with, say, this one here. All right, so I'm going to start by showing that one. All right, and then the other two will be similar. So, so compute. All right, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take for every epsilon. So if epsilon is bigger than zero, okay, and I'm going to show that that this L here is within epsilon of this sum. Okay, and that will suffice. So then, and let me do it by approximating the two that we know. So the integral of f restricted to AC dx from A to C, of course, is equal to the lower estimate of f restricted to AC. Okay, and let me see, let me get the right sign here. And this is bigger than or equal to, okay, let me write it as less than or equal to. Okay, so now I can approximate this by some approximate here, and that's within epsilon, right? That's what it is. So it's less than or equal to L of F restricted to AC with some partition, let me call it Q1, okay, plus epsilon. Okay, so I can get within epsilon of the answer by taking a fine enough partition. Okay, and then of course the same is true for the other one, so I'll just write that one quickly. So C to B, F restricted to CB, everything is exactly the same except I'm doing the other interval. So L, F restricted to CB, less than or equal to L, F restricted to CB associated with a partition. Okay, obviously this has to be a different partition because one is a partition of this set and the other is a partition of that set, right? So they're just totally unrelated things. So I'm just gonna call this one Q2. Okay, so that much we can get. Okay, but now how am I gonna get a partition for the total thing? Well, I'm just gonna take the Q1 and the Q2 and take their union, and that's gonna give me something that works for the whole thing, okay? Hence, So now let me just compute, and I have that L of F is, let's see, bigger than or equal to the L of F with the partition Q1 union Q2, right? That's a perfectly good partition of this whole set. And that's just equal to L of F restricted to AC with the partition Q1 plus L of F restricted to CB with the partition Q2, right? Because that's all it is. All I did was I broke this one up, I broke that one up, and they just add up. Okay, and so then this is greater than or equal to, all right, so here, let me just move those epsilons over to the other side, all right? And I get L of F restricted to AC minus epsilon plus L of F restricted to CB minus epsilon. Okay, and so we have, which is what we wanted. So since this is true for every epsilon, I have that L of F is equal to integral of F restricted to AC from A to C plus the integral from C to B of F restricted to CB. Okay, so that's what I wanted. And then the rest is similar. So U of F equals is similar. Okay, you just take partitions from the top instead of from the bottom. And implication this way is also similar. So there you just assume that you have a partition for the whole thing and just split it into a partition on the left and a partition on the right, and then you're done. Okay, so I am out of time, but what we have is another way of building Riemann integrable functions. You can smash them together, okay? And that's gonna get us a whole bunch more. And then there'll be just one more step and then we'll get all the ones we're gonna get. Let me stop the recording and I will stick around to answer questions if there are any.